I'm so glad that you got to hear Amanda's story. We love sharing the stories of the people whose God has been working in their lives, people who might be sitting right next to you right now. My name is Justin. I am a member of the speaking team and an elder here at Hoboken Grace, and I'm really glad that you're here joining us on this Labor Day weekend. I do hope that you are making yourself right at home, making yourself comfortable. I thought since I'm really motivated by your comfort today, that today we'd be talking about lounge chairs. Because they're comfortable, right? Actually, no. We're going to continue our 20-year series called This Crazy Book. It's a 20-year series that we've been working on, the Book of Acts. And you're thinking to yourself, a 20-year series? Yeah, that's right. We're committed to this. We are committed to this. And so it's true that we, from time to time, take time off of our series on the Book of Acts to do other things. But we are returning to it. And today we'll be returning to a passage that will really help you to understand why we called this series This Crazy Book. Because as you read this passage, you're like, wow, man, that's crazy. So let's take a look at this passage. It was written by Luke, who later on in a few years, we'll realize that Luke actually was part of the story, and he actually tells some of it from his first point of view. I guess a 20-year series is actually probably an interesting strategy for a church that's transient as Hoboken is. I mean, can you imagine this conversation? Hey, did you hear that I got the opportunity to go and be the district manager in Chicago? I'm really excited. You are, but wait, what about that series in Acts? In a couple years, they're going to be talking about Saul. I don't want to miss that. Oh, you're right. So it's an interesting strategy nonetheless. But we're going to go take a look at Acts chapter 5, verses 12 through 16. It says, "The apostles were performing many miraculous signs and wonders among the people. And all the believers were meeting regularly at the temple in the area known as Solomon's Colonnade. But no one else dared to join them, even though all the people had high regard for them. Yet more and more people believed and were brought to the Lord, crowds of both men and women. And as a result of the apostles' work, sick people were brought out into the streets on beds and mats so that Peter's shadow might fall across some of them as he went by. Crowds came from villages around Jerusalem, bringing their sick and those possessed by evil spirits, and they were all healed." Wow. You know, when I first saw that this was the passage I was going to be speaking on, and I realized it was six sentences, I thought, am I going to have enough to say? But now I realize we're going to be talking about miracles, so I'm going to tell you everything I know about miracles and try to cram it into the 3 hours that we have together. I'm kidding. Some of you are here for the first time, you're like, what, 3 hours? I didn't know. No, I won't be talking for 3 hours. And you might think to yourself, I've experienced the miraculous. I got a great parking spot out front today. But I want you to know that's not miraculous at all. It's just Labor Day here in Hoboken. Maybe next week when you get that prime parking spot, that might meet. No, not at all. I remember my first encounter with miraculous signs and healings. I was really young. I just started following Jesus Christ, just started on this journey. And the guy on stage had said, hey, everybody, you should be here next week. Come on Friday night. We're going to have this healing service where people who have physical needs are going to come and be healed. And I thought, well, okay, that doesn't really apply to me. But he said, no, everybody should be there. So I went. And as I'm there, I would love to tell you all the interesting details about the experience, but it ended up being a very awkward event for me because I was putting my hand on some gentleman's ear in preparation for his ear to be healed. And we were praying for like 10 minutes with my hand on this guy's ear. And then at the end of the service, he couldn't hear any better than he could before. I was so embarrassed. I thought, I must have done it wrong. I did something wrong. And the interesting thing is that he was just as embarrassed because he felt embarrassed too that he didn't get healed and somehow he had failed me. And we could barely even look at each other. It was really awkward. But it really informs something about these crazy stories about miraculous signs and miraculous healings, which is that they are remarkably improbable. They're not commonplace at all. They don't happen all the time. That's a part of what makes them crazy stories, is that it's not a common everyday event. And I love crazy stories. I do. I may love crazy stories more than most people, but I really love any story that starts out, "You would never believe what happened to me." I wouldn't either if I hadn't been there, but I got to tell you what happened. I love stories like that. I love them. I think you do too. I think you do. I think I have pretty good evidence that you do, because that's where clickbait comes in, right? Clickbait on the internet is all about, hey, check out these 18 cats you'll never believe. Or, hey, look at these 27 Tumblr posts that won't fit on a headline. Or, Robert Downey Jr. wants to sing with Sting, but he's embarrassed and nervous and he can't do it. But when he opens his mouth, it's unbelievable. And click, 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 click. We follow those links and figure out we wanted to be there. That's, yes, crazy stories. We want to see the improbable, the unexpected. We wanted to be there. That's what makes, part of what makes a crazy story is you kind of want to be there. Not every story is like that. I remember once I was scuba diving with my buddy, and it was kind of turbid and murky. And out of the darkness, we appeared this very large shark. It was huge. It was way bigger than either one of us. And as it's swimming towards us, we kind of look at each other like, wow. And then it turned and started swimming off into the darkness. And I turned and started swimming after the shark, because I wanted to see where it was going. And my buddy's like, And later he told me, no, I did not want to be part of that crazy story. I did not want to be there when you and that shark met up. No way. And when I tell that story, most of you agree, yes, I would not want to be part of that crazy story either. But this crazy story, the one that we're reading in Acts today, yeah, I think we'd want to be there. I mean, listen to two points of it. It says, the apostles were performing many miraculous signs and wonders among the people. Crowds came from villages around Jerusalem, bringing their sick and those possessed by evil spirits, and they were all healed. Pretty cool. Crazy, but cool. I think we'd want to be there. What do you think? What's your immediate reaction to that story? You know, there's a couple of reasons why we want to be there at these crazy stories. Maybe you know somebody who needs that kind of healing. Maybe there's somebody in your life who could use a miraculous sign, a miraculous healing. Or maybe it's because we want miracles to do something for us. We want miracles to confirm our existing beliefs. We want miracles to confirm our existing beliefs. But it turns out that that's not the case what they do. In fact, even if it were, it wouldn't really help us that much, right? We have a class called Rhythms, and one of the things that we talk about in our Rhythms class is that we're forgetful. And you might have actually been there at some miraculous event, some improbable event, and you would have an immediate impact. But then as the months and the years passed, it would have less of an effect on you. We see this, right? As we read the scriptures and we hear about people who are there for these incredible, amazing, miraculous events, we see that it doesn't affect them long term. And that's because that's not what it's necessarily designed to do. It's not designed to confirm a belief that I already have. No, what miraculous events are designed to do is to show that God has placed his authority on somebody who is speaking for him. In other words, he's placed his approval on what they're saying. Listen to what the writer of Hebrews tells us about it. He says, and God confirmed the message by giving signs and wonders and various miracles and gifts of the Holy Spirit whenever he chose. That's what these miracles are for. These miracles are to help us to know who God is, in fact, speaking through. And if we look at this account of what's going on in the lives of the apostles, it makes sense to us, right? Luke told us, to get us to this point, what happened so far? When the apostles first came to Jerusalem, they were terrified of the governing authority. They were terrified of the religious elite, and so they were in hiding. And they wouldn't have gone there at all if Jesus hadn't told them to go there. But when they went there, all of a sudden, God's Spirit descended upon them in an amazing and powerful way, in such a way that they began to be able to perform these miraculous signs and wonders too. And that they were able to also speak powerfully about who Jesus Christ was and what he came on earth to do, and that he had died and that he had been resurrected and that he was coming to rescue them. And all the while that is happening, the religious elite are conspiring, trying to figure out, okay, how can we get these guys to stop talking about this Jesus guy? How can we quash this belief? But despite that, and despite the fact that they arrested the apostles and arrested the disciples, despite that, people were still coming to know that Jesus is Lord. In fact, on one day, thousands of people all came to believe on the same day. But when they came to Jerusalem, they were nobodies. The disciples didn't have any credentials. They weren't members of the religious elite. They weren't rabbis. They weren't scribes. They weren't part of the government. They were fishermen and merchants and tax collectors. None of them had a degree from the University of Phoenix. They had no credentials. And so God needed to communicate, hey, these are the people who are bringing this paradigm shift. These are the guys who are communicating what I am actually doing in the world right now. And it was a paradigm shift. It was this incredible paradigm shift. One of the things that they were teaching people is that, you know, it used to be that access to God was on the basis of who your parents were. It depended on who your parents were, with whether or not how much access you had to God. And Jesus came and said, no, that's not it anymore. I'm giving everyone access to God. And the disciples are teaching this incredible paradigm shift that's saying, no, access to God is no longer dependent upon who you are born to. It's now based on whether or not you receive Jesus Christ as Lord, whether or not you accept this gift that he's giving you. It's a huge shift. So far, I've used two terms sort of interchangeably, and I want to clarify. I've used the term disciple, and I've used the term apostle. And they're very different terms, and they can't be used interchangeably. A disciple is somebody who has sort of pledged to themselves that they're going to follow a particular person and live their life to emulate their lifestyle, whereas an apostle is somebody that God sends to change the paradigm, to bring a new understanding, a new great belief, to change a great moral system. But I use the terms interchangeably because they're pointing to the same group of people. The apostles and the disciples were actually the same people, these people who were at the very beginning following Jesus Christ, those who were closest to him. It's sort of like the planet Venus. In the morning, you look up and you see this bright heavenly body and you say, that's the morning star. It's actually the planet Venus. And in the evening, you look up just at sunset and you look up and you go, hey, that's the evening star. But no, it's just the planet Venus. These two terms refer to the same planet. In the same way, these two terms, the disciples and the apostles, are actually referring to the same group of people, these first followers of Jesus Christ. And they were coming in without credentials, without any status, and they're saying, hey, we are changing the paradigm of how people are understanding who God is. And so God is placing his approval on what they're doing and what they're saying by these miraculous signs and wonders. Mark talks about it in his gospel too. He says, and the disciples went everywhere and preached, and the Lord worked through them, confirming what they said by many miraculous signs. And so God uses these miracles not to confirm our pre-existing beliefs, but in order to demonstrate who is in fact speaking for him and who is bringing this great change of understanding. In fact, the Apostle Paul, later on, he says, when I was with you, I certainly gave you proof that I am an apostle. I'm one of these people, change agents people. For I patiently did many signs and wonders and miracles among you. So it was understood that these miracles were stamped on these people to validate that they were speaking for God and that they were the ones who were bringing this great change in our understanding of who God is. So that leads us to the next step of this, which is to say, well, if miracles are not designed to confirm my pre-existing belief, but instead to confirm who is speaking for God, then why are they so hard to believe? There are some things in the Bible that are easier to believe, like that guys would cut a hole in the roof and lower somebody down in hopes that Jesus would heal them, or that the religious authorities were challenging and trying to quash the spreading the message of Jesus Christ. These things are easier to believe, but there are some things that are harder to believe, like that over 5,000 people would be fed with a few pieces of bread and some fish, or that two men would walk on the water, or that the people brought the sick and the ailing to Jerusalem and they were healed. They were all healed. These things are harder to believe. And I get that. I get the tension for that. I mean, after all, I have trouble believing that one space after a period is enough, much less these difficult concepts. And you might be saying to yourself, you know, I'm just starting this to explore the claims of Jesus Christ, and you have just expressed my hesitation completely, that it's hard to believe some of the things that the Bible says. And I want you to know something. The doubt is reasonable in these circumstances. Doubt's a reasonable thing. There's nothing inherently wrong with doubt. You're not immediately wrong because of doubt. It's a reasonable reaction to this. Because guess what we're saying? Something incredible, something amazing, something unexpected is happening that wouldn't have happened unless the direct intervention of the living God. It's reasonable. If we can be reassured by the apostles that they also struggled in disbelief. A couple weeks ago, Anthony was talking about how Peter was in the boat and they saw Jesus approaching the boat, actually literally walking on top of the water. And he gets out of the boat and he starts walking on top of the water too. And he's literally on top of the water and he begins to doubt. In the midst of that miracle, he's experiencing it right then and there. He begins to doubt. Why? Because he's just overwhelmed with the possibility. How could this be happening? When we encounter the miraculous, when we encounter this amazing, improbable God who's just doing something phenomenal, something completely unexpected, it's reasonable to doubt. It is. We look at the disciples and how they reacted to the resurrection, and we'll see that they doubt in the midst of it. So let me set the stage. Jesus has died on the cross. They saw him dead. They buried him. Then a few days later, they see him, that he's alive again, and they have these meetings with him where they encounter him on the road, and they're sharing their experiences of how they've encountered the living Jesus again, and all of a sudden, he's there in their midst. And listen to how Luke records it. He says, just as they were telling about it, Jesus himself was suddenly standing there among them. Peace be with you, he said. But the whole group was startled and frightened, thinking they were seeing a ghost. Why are you frightened, he asked. Why are your hearts filled with doubt? Look at my hands, look at my feet, you can see it's really me. Touch me and make sure that I am not a ghost, because ghosts don't have bodies, as you see that I do. And as he spoke, he showed them his hands and his feet. He's saying, it's me, it's Jesus. Look, see, you can see when they nailed me to the cross, you can see the wounds on my hands, on my feet. I'm here, I'm right here before you. And in the midst of seeing this, they've already seen him before, in the midst of seeing them in his presence, they are filled with doubt again. In the midst of this amazing miracle that is just incomprehensible, improbable, outside their expectations. It's reasonable to doubt. It goes on to say, still they stood there in disbelief, filled with joy and wonder. Then he asked them, do you have anything here to eat? And they gave him a piece of broiled fish and he ate it as they watched. In the midst of this, they are recognizing, wow, this is an amazing event. And they are filled with joy. They're filled with joy and wonder. But it's still overwhelming to them. It's still overwhelming to them. It's reasonable to doubt. But we can't let doubt control us. We can't let doubt dominate us. Carlo Broussard wrote a response to David Hume about his comments about miracles. And in it, Broussard says, sometimes those who disbelieve miracles set the standard of improbability so high that nothing could ever be believable. And it's not fair to take that and take the standard to the point where the unbelievability of it is unbelievable. And so he writes, he says, the wise man surely needs to exercise caution when confronted with accounts of the miraculous. But the wise man should also be open to following the evidence where it leads, no matter how extraordinary and improbable it is. And although the disciples were taken aback at the resurrection, and they really didn't know what the next step was, they didn't let that doubt dominate them. In fact, they didn't stop proclaiming the miracle that they had seen the resurrected Jesus Christ. In the face of the government, in the face of being told not to do, in the face of being arrested, they continued to proclaim this miracle. In fact, they continued to proclaim it, some to the point where they were tortured to the point of death, and they wouldn't stop proclaiming what they had seen, the resurrected Jesus Christ. They didn't let doubt, like how could this possibly happen, ensnare them and hold them back from continuing to act. In fact, neither did the people around Jerusalem. In Acts chapter 5, verses 15 and 16, we see this. They said, as a result of the apostles' work, sick people were brought out into the streets on beds and mats so that Peter's shadow might fall across some of them as he went by. Crowds came from the villages around Jerusalem, bringing their sick and those possessed by evil spirits, and they were all healed. Despite the improbability of what was going on in Jerusalem, they acted. They didn't let the doubt ensnare them. Instead, they came with hope. Hope that God would actually heal their neighbors and their friends and their family. And he did. And he did. He healed them. And I think this is where the improbability of miracles and our desire to be there meet. In action. And I could feel the hesitation, like, wait, you want me to actually act on these crazy stories? The Onion never makes me act on crazy stories. BuzzFeed only asks me to make quizzes. Of course not, they're fake news. This is real life. These are real people. These are real things that happen to them. Of course we're being called to act. Of course we're going to have to act. And as you think about the miraculous, as you think about what's going on, and sometimes we get caught up in the physical miraculous, but really, nowadays, we treat physical injury differently than they did 2,000 years ago. We encounter that in a different way than they did. But now when we think about those who are injured and those who need healing, we often think about what's going on inside. That they feel despair. That they feel destitute. They feel rejected. They've been manipulated, or they've been manipulators. Something horrible has happened to them, or they've done horrible things. When we think about healing today, we often think about what's going on inside of us. And it's not because I want to diminish the word miraculous or I want to diminish the word improbable and I want to take away and say, oh, this is commonplace. No, it's still miraculous. But when we think about the brokenness that we experience, we can then realize that God still intervenes. Just because the miraculous is improbable does not mean that God still isn't at work in our lives and that he can intervene and he can heal. And he can repair and restore. I've experienced this in my own life in a kind of a unique way, in that before I became a follower of Christ, I was homeless. I was literally living on the streets. I would eat the food that other people had cast away because they didn't want it. And I would sleep in buildings where I could. Sometimes they didn't even have roofs. And I remember one time in particular, I'd eaten something that was so terrible that my body was completely racked with pain. And I was writhing in pain in a ditch, trying to keep from getting too cold and wet in the snow. And that person has no idea how in the world it would be possible for me to be standing right here in front of you wearing clothes I bought for myself, having enough to eat, having a safe place to stay. From inside that story, it's miraculous. It's improbable. And yet God, in his pursuit of me, rescued me from that. Just like he rescued Amanda. Just like he rescued Amanda in her situation, how she was grieving, excuse me, and how she was struggling, and she was living a life that was leading towards disaster. And then God intervened in her life and brought such healing that no one would have expected. When we look at the brokenness in our lives, we would say, no, I don't see how this is going to go better unless somebody intervenes. And God did. God intervened in her and repaired the relationship, not only repairing the relationship between her and her Heavenly Father, but between her and her mother. And maybe that's why you're here today, because you've seen that in somebody's life. You've seen that despite the wounds that they had, the festering wounds that were destroying them and tearing them apart, there's been a remarkable change. There's been a radical change to a new direction. Despite the way things likely would have gone, they haven't gone that way. And you look at it and you say, someone intervened. Someone intervened. And so they take action. We take action. And I don't know what that action is for you. I don't. Maybe you're here and you're just now starting out your exploration of the claims of Jesus Christ. Maybe you came here for the very first time and you're just saying, I don't know who Jesus is, and I don't know if I believe that he said that he was God and that I should follow him. I don't know, but I want to encourage you to come. Come and bring us your story. Come bringing your doubts and your confusion and the tension that we have when we encounter the miraculous, when we encounter the improbable. This isn't a place where you have to hide those things. Come and bring them and let's discuss them. I don't know where you are, but don't let your doubt keep you from the healing and the miracle that God wants to do in your life. Join a dinner group. Let us get to know you. Get to know us. Or maybe you've already taken that step. Maybe you've already acknowledged that, yeah, I am going to receive this gift that Jesus is offering for free. But you're thinking about, what is that next step for you? I just want to encourage you to take that step, whatever it is. You know, we're found people. At once, we were lost, but now we are found. And that's only possible because of what Jesus Christ did on our behalf, how he brought us back to the Father and brought us into this healing, and we've started to experience this miraculous healing in our lives. Don't allow doubt to keep you from inviting somebody to come and experience it with you. Who are you going to bring to God's healing? Whatever that step is, let's embrace the stories of healing, these miraculous, improbable stories of healing. Let's embrace them. You know, doubt Doubt is a normal course of a reasonable reaction to the improbable. It's a reasonable reaction to this beautiful thing that God is doing, this majestic thing, this that he's pouring his love out into us. And even though we might forget, he keeps pouring it out. He keeps calling us and telling us about this amazing love he has for us. So don't let doubt freeze us and keep us from engaging in the miraculous stories of the people who live with us, our coworkers and our friends and our family. Come, bring them along to wherever he's leading them, to this incredible, amazing, improbable story he's telling in your life and in theirs. Will you pray with me? God, you are amazing. The way in which you continue to pour your love out on us is so great. That you have chosen to heal us, that you have chosen to rescue us, we're so grateful. And that you keep reaching out to the people around us, that you're not satisfied, but you want to bring more to know you. Thank you so much. Help us. Help us to have the courage to take that next step, whatever it is. Help us to not let doubt destroy us and keep us down, but instead to turn to you. Thank you for what you've already done. We can't wait to what you're going to see you do in the future. Amen.